So we will start the session today with Betsy Corcoran, a longtime friend and colleague of mine. Betsy was my editor at Forbes. She was a very, very well-known technology journalist and editor. That's when we got to know each other. But then she went on to found EdSurge and is today probably the most knowledgeable person in the educational technology industry on the planet. Welcome, Betsy. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Shramana. I'm delighted to be here and really glad to have a chance to talk with you again.
Absolutely. Betsy, can you give our audience a little bit of your vision of what you're trying to do with EdSurge?
Absolutely. So as you said, we started EdSurge about 4 years ago. And I did, in fact, quit my job at Forbes to do that, which at that point during the downturn was really a very scary thing. But what I had spent, as you know, Shramana, many, many years writing about technology across many different fields. And what I observed were that there were certain characteristics that happened in an ecosystem when a new industry was being formed. At the same time, I am a mom. I had sons in the public schools here in Northern California, and it seemed to me that there was a really big gap between what we saw happening in the schools and what I knew was going on in technology in the wider world. So the spur to quit my job really was to see if there was something I could contribute between kind of bridging what I saw in the technology world and what I saw in the education world. As I spent a whole year really immersing myself in education, working very, very intently with a number of schools in the area, and felt that I learned tremendously from many educators and many of the experiences that I had. And then toward the end of that year, I started to see these aspects of an ecosystem coming together. And at that point, what I felt was that I could make a contribution in two different ways using the journalism background that I had. First was to try to be a forum for exchanging information about the entrepreneurial world and about how people were trying to start companies, how they were trying to form this ecosystem. And then the second thing, which was really important to me, was to try to provide another source of independent information, really one of the few at that point, that was trying to talk about what tools were relevant for what environment. You know, not every piece of education technology should be used in every school. Not every teacher should use the same thing. It's sort of like if you were having lunch and you ordered a bowl of soup and somebody handed you a fork, you'd have a very unsatisfying experience. And so really we founded EdSurge with two ideas. One is to support this emerging ecosystem, but then very powerfully to help people, to help educators see the difference between a fork and a spoon. And so we really devoted the last 4 years to that. We write a lot of news and we share a lot of news. We have two weekly newsletters along with our blog, excuse me, which is at edsurge.com. We host now about 12 different conferences around the United States, as well as regular meetups here in the Northern California area. And we are building out a set of tools that we hope will start to kind of give educators more support as they try to figure out what's the right piece of technology for the teaching environment, for the needs of their students, for the needs of their schools. So, so that's what we're doing.
Fantastic. So let's actually dig down into what you see in this ecosystem that you've now immersed yourself in. We've seen a lot of action, a lot of experiments, a lot of innovation in the EdTech space in the recent years. For a long time, EdTech was not a highly active space from a technology industry point of view, but now it is. And just a few weeks back, we had Anant Agarwal, CEO of FedEx, as a guest here, and we discussed the future of higher ed with him. So how would you summarize the key ed tech trends today?
Sure. So we're seeing, well, I guess a couple of starting thoughts for you. First, we're starting to get more sophisticated about talking about education. When we talk about education, we're talking about a huge spectrum of activities, right? There's what happens when children are very small, preschool. There's what happens in the home. There's what happens in formal school environments. And there's what happens as people get older, either post-secondary, university, or later in life, in the workforce, and really lifelong learning. So number one is we're starting to get a lot more sophisticated about when we talk about learning, when we talk about creating a collection of tools for supporting learning, who are we really talking about? I think you, Shramana, do a wonderful job with your community of making sure that number one, you're always thinking about who are the customers, what's the need you're trying to serve. So point number one is we're starting to get a lot more sophisticated in education about really talking about which part of this ecosystem are we talking about, what are the needs that we're talking about. So that's kind of point number one. Kind of a second point that goes along with that is that we're getting a lot more sophisticated within education of thinking about what are really the needs of the people in those communities. So once again, let's talk for a moment about K-12, so that community of learners that that are usually kids in formal school settings. Even within this sector, there's a lot of differences that we see. We talk about digital curriculum, which are literally the tools that teachers might use to help educate kids. But we also talk about tools for supporting teachers. We talk about tools for supporting the schools. So you can start to see that there's a lot more complexity than just kind of this hand-wavy thing about, oh, is there, you know, what does education technology involve? The third point is that at the core of learning are people. And I think that, you know, we have sometimes heard conversations and questions about, oh, well, are we trying to replace teachers with technology? I don't think we're any more trying to replace teachers with technology than somebody would say you use transportation technology to replace your feet. You don't use transportation technology to replace your feet. You use it to augment and to support and make it possible for you to go someplace that candidly you're probably not going to walk to. So if I'm going to travel from New York to California, I'm probably not going to walk. I could, but it will take me a long time. Instead, I'm more likely to take some sort of piece of technology, a plane, a train, probably not a boat, but I'm going to look for a kind of technology that will augment my ability to get from point A to point B. So in the same way, we at EdSearch fundamentally believe that teachers are at the heart of learning, that people are at the heart of learning. We are inspired by people. The more interesting question is, okay, so what are ways, what are the tools that can augment the way that we learn, the way that people can inspire us, the way that people teach? So we're starting to get a lot more sophisticated and a lot more thoughtful about thinking about the role of technology in supporting the education process. And then the last thing is that we're really happily, you know, rethinking a lot of what we mean by education. So for instance, you know, many of us have been in school where school consists of going to a lecture, taking a collection of notes, memorizing or learning those notes, and kind of regurgitating what we just learned. So there are some instances in which that is a useful mechanism for learning. But most of the time when we're learning, we're exploring the world. We want to create something. We don't want to just prove to someone else that we can spit back something that they already know. We want to move the world forward a little bit. And guess what? Learners of all ages want to do that. So we've heard a lot, we've started to talk a lot, even in the K-12 framework, about how do you personalize learning? Well, why do we want to personalize it? Because everyone really wants to be on a learning voyage themselves. And so the last kind of question that's really exciting is, how do we make sure that we're using tools to support learning, to support this personal journey of discovery of how do we learn in the world? What are the tools that support that? And how do we create an environment? How do we create sort of learning environments that support that as well? So, you know, these are some of the really big questions that we're talking about. Now, there's a whole other set of questions, which I haven't addressed, which have to do with, you know, do we have an infrastructure for supporting this? Do we have a social infrastructure that recognizes this? Those are a lot of big questions, too. So it's a fascinating time to be part of thinking about what learning and education means. Last thing I'd like to say is that, to this point, is that, you know, we think of different eras in history. We think of, you know, you can go back to whatever era you like. You can go back to the Bronze Age. You can talk about the Industrial Age. When we think about the world that we're creating, that you're creating with the entrepreneurs whom you are mentoring and you are working with, what's clear about the world going forward is we are all going to be learners for our entire lives. Things that change too quickly for us to feel that we've figured out everything about a job and all we need to do is do it over and over. Shramana, you and I worked together at Forbes. The skills that we learned were super relevant at that moment, but we couldn't do exactly what we did at Forbes. Now, if we did, we wouldn't really be very relevant to the world. We all have to keep learning. So we're in an era now where our ability to learn and our ability to change is going to be fundamental for us creating our lives and our futures and the opportunities in front of us. So I don't think there's any effort that's really more exciting and more open to innovation and change than this whole area of learning and how we build a collection of tools and processes for supporting that.
So Betsy, that's a great overview. You mentioned segments, and you know, for the world that we are in, we are, you know, entrepreneurs, and you're talking to a community of entrepreneurs for whom it's vitally important to understand the segments. If you want to do anything in entrepreneurship, we have to understand which segment precisely, which customer are we building a solution for. So can you pick a few of the key segments in education and give us your thoughts about what you're seeing, what are the, you know, what you can take whatever tack, whether it's trends, whether it's examples of interesting companies that you've seen that speak to those trends, or even business models, and, you know, what's emerging as good entrepreneurial segments. So K-12, let's start with K-12. It's probably the one that's most complicated, actually, because of education being a public good. This is a segment where entrepreneurs are still having a lot of trouble. What are your thoughts on that? What are your observations?
And I'm sorry, I have to ask you to repeat one thing. I missed the word that you described. Which segment you specifically asked about again? The words got lost.
K-12.
K-12. Oh, right. Sure. Okay. Big segment. So let's kind of break it down a little bit, and let's talk explicitly about K-12. So what happens in the K-12 segment? We are interested in getting information to the schools. We're interested in how one manages information within the context of the school. We're interested in how people manage information and get it to people outside of the school, namely parents and the people who are supporting learners. So let's talk about a couple of specifics. One of the companies that we've seen that has been extremely interesting is a company called Clever. They started about 4 years ago, and they had a pretty simple observation, which is that many schools use different varieties of student information systems to store information about their students, whether that's grades, attendance, et cetera. SISs are, in many instances, kind of the fundamental backbone for school data systems. But it turned out that many of the entrepreneurs who were building tools, they would have to connect into these SIS systems But there were many SIS systems. And so how would entrepreneurs approach a school, be able to kind of second guess which SIS system would be there, and particularly if they were a small company, be able to plug into that SIS system so that a school could even try out or test or experiment with their technology. Clever came in and said, we'll be the bridge. We'll be a glue. We're going to create basically kind of a universal platform so that any incoming application could plug in through Clever and connect to whatever variety of SIS system was in the school. Incredibly powerful idea, complicated piece of technology, but very fundamental for helping kind of technologies get into the school. So that's been a very powerful example of something. Here's another example. Working within the schools, we are seeing there are a lot of SIS systems. There also are a lot of, versions of learning management systems. That's probably still a pretty frothy area. We've seen there was traditionally Blackboard, which was a very big learning management system that's had kind of challengers coming in. We see some other big, relatively big companies now, a company called Instructure, which is now probably about 7 or 8 years old, is now really vying with Blackboard to kind of be in that learning management category. They're trying to do a little bit of everything. They're trying to be a big basket and say we can organize everything. So now the question is, okay, so who's going to work well with different learning management systems? And so we're seeing a lot more specific applications. We're seeing gradebook applications, there's quite a lot of those, and some of those are catering to the types of tests so that in the United States schools are very interested in, such as Common Core. Some of the kind of gradebook-like applications are actually catering to project-based learning. There's kind of a really interesting collection of those that are saying, how do you create a portfolio of learning management? How do you create a portfolio of activities for students that aren't just grades, but maybe kind of capture digital representations of performances or of projects or something like that? How do you manage those? Super interesting. Then there's a whole collection of communications technologies about connecting back to the classroom. So again, a couple of other companies that have become very interesting has been Remind, which is a messaging system that helps teachers connect back with parents. There's one called Class Dojo, which is around class management. So again, what we are really seeing is people kind of breaking down the pipeline of what has to happen. We know students come into school. We know something happens to them. We know that they go home. And so the smart entrepreneurs are really kind of diving into the specific areas of that whole pipeline. And then there's one other huge area, which is the education of teachers themselves or professional development. We've seen a lot of innovation around using techniques such as, using video to collect and record teachers teaching in class. And then how do they get mentors and comments from their colleagues about how to improve their teaching techniques? So bottom line is that schools are a really complex ecosystem, and you're exactly right, Shramana, that kind of really diving down and looking at kind of what are the needs of the teachers, the communications needs, school needs, are where we're seeing some really interesting innovations.
And where do you see the content side of all this? Are we getting to any conclusions? Is the content going to come from digital versions or digital enhancements of user experience from the textbook providers, the app guys? What's the evolution of the content story?
So that's a really interesting question. We certainly have seen a tremendous explosion of content on math and on English language arts. And we're seeing kind of two different directions. We're seeing more players come in and say, we have a different way of thinking through, for instance, how to teach math, or we have a different way of thinking about what are, how do you have a group discussion in a world that may be partially bricks and mortar and partially virtual around, say, a piece of writing or something like that. But once again, we're also seeing a lot of efforts to support how do we help teachers and students also sometimes create their own content, either help teachers create their own lessons and share those lessons out, or you know, what are ways that we can support student collaboration so that there is also kind of creation of content there. So it's definitely not a world that's owned by the textbook manufacturers any longer. We do see certainly textbook companies are trying very hard, and one that's kind of interesting is I think we're seeing McGraw-Hill take a very, very active role in what's called adaptive learning, which is that they are developing a collection of algorithms that look at how students move through a body of work, and they are trying to create different learning pathways for students going through that material. So if you and I encounter one math problem and you answer it one way and I answer it another way, they're trying to understand, what did Betsy not understand that Shramana did understand, and let's repair or fill in the gaps in Betsy's knowledge, and let's take Shramana on an advanced course or something like that. So the adaptive programs are extremely interesting. They are involved the most amount of what's called big data, deep data analysis. That means that they also have an underbelly, which is that they are collecting a lot of information on students and on student performance, and that's raised a whole other set of questions, which is around who owns that data, where does that data live, should students have the right to pull out or withdraw their data? So there's a whole collection of really fascinating questions around that. So I guess in summary, I'd say that some of the most aggressive use of algorithms are things that we are seeing the bigger companies do, because those are pretty complicated things, often involving larger teams of people to think through that. They are fascinating. They do have real risks involved, but they also have great opportunities. The question you're going to ask me, Shramana, because I know you this well, is you're going to say, well, Betsy, what's really working out there? You're telling me that there's all these kind of interesting experiments, but what works? And that's a really big question, and we're still figuring that out. We're still trying to understand. We're still trying to, number one, understand how we know what works. We're seeing some efforts to develop shorter testing protocols so that we can, in less time than a semester or a year, sort of try to analyze, are we helping a student kind of achieve greater learning performance? But that's still at an early stage. So we are still, this is still a field that's very, very much in the laboratory and still very much in development.
So what do you think is the timeline? Are we talking maybe by the end of the decade we start seeing some answers? Because these are long-term experiments.
It's got to be a lot sooner than that, right? Because most of us, we don't want to have our kids stay in fourth grade for an entire decade. So we really do. We are seeing an enormous effort to look for shorter-term protocols, where sometimes those shorter-term protocols, people hope they could be as short as 2 weeks, to say, are we seeing some useful outcomes of using a piece of technology in a particular environment? Those protocols are very much in development. We're seeing both the U.S. Department of Education as well as some of the foundations, such as the Gates Foundation, put a lot of money into developing pilot centers, where those centers are trying to develop protocols that people feel will have some real results and some very defendable results behind them. So, no, we've got to figure this out much sooner than a decade, but we haven't figured it out quite yet.
So on this topic, my last question is actually about business models, which I'm sure you knew that I would ask you as well.
Yeah.
So entrepreneurs will have to build businesses. We understand that there is a big portion of the K-12 segment that depends on grants, and the Gates Foundation is playing a big role in trying to figure this out, and all of that's great. What about the entrepreneurs who are trying to actually build for-profit businesses and even venture-funded businesses out of this industry? What business models are you seeing that are working, and what are some examples of companies that are, you know, executing on business models that are working?
Yeah, so you're right. There's been a lot of confusion and complexity in this world. We certainly, I'll say one thing, which is I think that we can't say that the models are 100% clear at this point, right? But I'll tell you what we seem to have learned over the last 4 years. Number one is that teachers appreciate the fact that if you are not buying the product, that you are the product, right? And so there's, I think, nervousness in many instances among educators that if a product seems to be free, that, you know, someone's collecting data on them, and so it's not as free, is not as free as one likes to be. So we are seeing more educators say, if we can get a price that is, you know, not extraordinarily large, we would rather actually sometimes pay for something rather than get it, quote, for free. So we've seen a number of companies that have really diligently built out business models where they are charging from day one. One of the companies that's quite interesting is a company called Hapara, H-A-P-A-R-A. It actually began in New Zealand, and it began by selling its product, which is, in a sense, almost like a dashboard for managing Google Apps in a school. Predated Google Apps for schools, and actually has a tremendous amount of functionality that at this point even goes beyond some of what Google offers. And they've always charged, and they have done a wonderful job of first building a business originally in New Zealand, and then coming to the U.S. market with a little bit of strength, and continuing to always sell their product. Anything that is aimed at a school where there is a here's the funny thing about schools. Money comes in buckets in schools. So it's worthwhile spending a little time thinking about which bucket of money, if you are selling a product, would your product fit into? The schools do set aside fairly significant money for professional development. So we see many professional development tools, and these are tools that help teachers be better teachers, come with a price tag, never be free. Because number one, they recognize that there's the ability to pay for that, and they therefore, you know, then the question is, how do we set a price that's not unreasonable for schools, a fair price, but one that they're willing to pay? So that's a very powerful thing. And we, you know, we certainly have seen many, many freemium models. Some of them have worked and some of them haven't. We have also seen there's another company that's really worth mentioning. There's a company called Quizlet, which has offered a collection of sort of mechanisms for studying, right, like flashcards online. Mm-hmm. They had a fascinating business model. They have been entirely bootstrapped. You'd be very proud of them, Shramana. You should really have them on your show here. But they've been entirely bootstrapped. They have never taken any venture money. They're actually very, very large and a very dominant player right now. They actually funded the original business through another business. So the team of people who started Quizlet originally started Quizlet as a free flashcard application. And they funded it by starting a small antique sales business on the side. And so they cross-subsidized the business until such time that they had enough momentum with Quizlet that they're actually generating significant revenue through advertising and then through a premium product. And so they're a wonderful example of someone who very purposefully bootstrapped with another mechanism for funding until they had enough volume and they had enough demonstration in the marketplace of the need for the product that they could really use these other mechanisms, namely a great premium product and premium services and some advertising support. So Quizlet is one that I think should be a real hero you know, in your constellation here?
So, folks, we have Betsy for just half an hour. I want to give you some pointers on the subject of guests we've had also covering other aspects of online education, educational technology. We had Anant Agarwal here recently talking about the future of higher education. Anant is the CEO of edX, which is a joint venture between Harvard and MIT in the MOOCs category. Anant is also my advisor at MIT, so we go back a long way. And another company, speaking of highly capital efficient ed tech companies, I don't know, Betsy, have you run into Magoosh?
Absolutely. Magoosh is a lovely company. We've seen them a number
lovely
of times.
Company.
Yeah, and no, they've been delightful. One of the things that we do is we sponsor a series of I mentioned conferences around the United States, where we bring together teachers and entrepreneurs, and the idea isn't to sell the products. The idea is to really have an exchange where the entrepreneurs can say, here's what we're trying to do, and the teachers can say, oh, this is how it fits into my environment, this is how it doesn't fit into my environment. I think we've seen Magoosh at some of these as well. So we're fans.
Magoosh is a wonderful company. So folks, you can check out our session with Pavin Parekh, who's the CEO of Magoosh. They've really done a superb job of capital efficient entrepreneurship. So definitely worth checking out. Betsy, thank you so much for sharing your...
One last thing that I've neglected to mention that I really would like to mention for your entrepreneurs as a resource. So if on our site, which is edsurge.com, if you go to edsurge.com/products, you'll see what we call the EdSurge Index. That currently is a catalog of close to 1,500 education technology tools. And so, Shramana, I know that you advise your folks to be really thoughtful about your research. When you're researching a category, when you're thinking about what your product is, one of the key issues is, okay, who else is in the space and what else are they doing? The EdTech Index is an incredibly powerful place for you to find out who else is doing what. And so it's totally open, it's totally free. People are, we want people to use it. We have descriptions of the tools in various forms. We have many tools that have long descriptions. We have all tools characterized. And then the tools that have participated in our conferences, and I think there's more than 150 of them now, also have significant commentary from teachers that we collect at our conferences embedded in those product profiles. And so there's a lot of rich information for anyone who's doing their homework on what to do in this space.
And Betsy, what we'll do is also incorporate the EdTech Index into our curriculum in the online education section. So
that way,
for the competitive analysis, it would be a very good tool to dovetail into. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for all the work you're doing, Betsy. This is wonderful. What you're doing is amazing, and it's great to see you blossom.
Well, Shramana, you are an inspiration to me and to millions of entrepreneurs around the world. So thank you, and it's great to have a good excuse to come and chat with you again.
And we'll do that again. Thanks, Betsy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.